as will become clear quite quickly, I've cheated this time. This is the only session which we do just one chapter of John's Gospel, and I thought I was being clever by doing it on John 17, guessing wrongly that that would be a chapter perhaps with more in than anything else. And in fact, it turned out, in my mind at least, to be less than anything else. We could have spent some time in the sort of narrow byways of Greek and does a very small detail out of John 17, but I thought actually it's much more use to do something a bit different. And so I'm going to step sideways from it for part of the session, unless, of course, before I do that, you want to bring me enough questions, puzzles, conundra from the chapter that I shall stay in it. Mike, would you very kindly read that first paragraph on the sheet to us?
Chapter 17 is perhaps the densest, the hardest to understand of the whole Gospel. Often described as the high priestly prayer, it is perhaps best approached as John's commentary on and expansion of the Lord's Prayer, which doesn't occur elsewhere in the Gospel. In fact, there's not much in the chapter that is clearer or more illuminating in the original Greek than in the English translation. And so in this session, we'll range a little more widely into the Lord's Prayer itself.
So for most of this session, in fact, really for all of it, because the bit we're doing from John 17 is also in the Lord's Prayer, we're going to be looking at the Lord's Prayer in Greek rather than John 17 on the whole. So if you want to bring any questions from John 17, you're most welcome, and I shall tell you what I think, if I think anything at all. Okay, so Val, would you kindly read on my sheet?
The one significant point that's lost in translation in this chapter, as in the Lord's Prayer itself, comes in verse 15. I am not asking you to take them out of the world, but I am asking you to protect them from the evil one. Nouns and adjectives in the New Testament Greek, as in Latin and many other modern languages, have genders, masculine, feminine and neuter, he, she and it. And for much of the time in Greek, the masculine and the neuter are indistinguishable from each other.
Okay, stop there if you would, please. I mean, I guess we're all educated and sensible and intelligent and stuff, so we know that in French, a table is not it, it's she, la table. And a lot of modern languages have two genders, masculine and feminine, which bear more or less relationship to our idea of what we used to call sex, but now call gender, with people. When I was young, people had sex and things had gender. Nowadays, everyone seems to have gender. So, as far as I'm aware, most modern languages have masculine and feminine. I don't know many modern languages, though. But most ancient languages, or many ancient languages, have three, masculine, feminine, and neuter. And it does seem to be slightly random what things are neuter and what are masculine and feminine. There are a few obvious things are masculine or feminine. A king is masculine and a queen is feminine. I mean, I think all languages observe those sort of distinctions, which is just so obvious.
Ships tend to be feminine.
Well, yes, exactly. And then you find what's common. Ships tend to be feminine, and so do sailors. So clearly, nothing has changed down the centuries. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cars.
Cars, yes, cars.
She's going well today.
Yes. The two professions that tend to be feminine in Latin are sailors and farmers. Which is interesting. Don't know why. Once you start looking for logic, you soon give up the attempt. But that's not so important for our purposes, though it's quite interesting. I'm just doing this with the youngsters up at Hatherwick Castle at the moment, in fact.
But isn't there a difference between being feminine and having a feminine ending?
Yes. Okay, how far do you want to get into this? If you regard A as a feminine ending, as opposed to merely a first declension ending in Latin, then yes, there is.
Well, I think it's because of that, isn't it? It's because things are, it's not a simplistic either or thing.
No, okay. I think what I'm saying, I'll get a stage further in then, is that conventionally speaking, we talk about nouns in ending an A in Latin, like mensa. Do you remember back across the decades as being first declension? And because all of them are feminine, we then start using sloppy language, which Liz doesn't allow, clearly, and saying things like, yes, that farmers and sailors have feminine endings. They don't. They merely have first declension endings. But thank you, Liz.
You're quite right.
Well, we won't get into a fight about it, but
we'll have to separate you.
Like a lot of things, that when you know the rules, then you are allowed to break them. That there are lots of things that you can say normally, because we were discussing this last night at choir, saying that I is the subject and me is the object. But actually, you do sound very effective if you, nowadays, affected, if you say it is I, don't you? And we would say it is me. And yes. I was trying to argue with Sheila Verve last night that that's the me is being used for emphasis. It doesn't mean it's the object. Because and not, you say c'est moi, don't you, in French?
Yes, exactly. It's not an accusative, it's a dative.
It's not an accusative.
C'est moi.
Yes.
C'est moi, de Gaulle.
Yes. And so, it's the same maths, isn't it? What you learn in maths at a primary level, you sort of then have to unlearn if you do a maths degree. So I understand from my friends who do maths that it's a lot more, things are a lot more complicated when you look into them in more detail. That's all I'm really saying.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But language always does the easiest. It's like water, it chooses the easiest route, so it's much easier to say it's me than it is I.
The easiest thing to say, yes, that's right. And so as the centuries go by, languages simplify.
Yes.
So if you compare classical Greek and New Testament Greek, New Testament Greek is simpler. It's dropped, it's got an indicative as adjunctive, it's lost the optative. It's got a singular and a plural, it's lost the dual. So, I mean, you find this language is simplifying. You do find they're getting more complex in other directions, though. You find that languages, as years go by, become increasingly compounded. So you start using auxiliary verbs. I will go. I have eaten. Whereas earlier forms of the language use uncompounded. Latin, I loved, is a marvi, or as we used to say in my day, a marvi. But in medieval Latin, it's quite like to be habeo amatus, I have loved. So you see, languages can get more complex in certain ways because they use more auxiliaries. But I mean, we can have a fun language session as well if you want. I'm very happy. I taught language all day.
No, it's all right.
Is it?
Right.
Yep. Okay. Yes, there we are. We're looking at this in theory so far. Much of the time in Greek, the masculine and the neuter are indistinguishable from each other. In fact, if you want to know, it's normally only in the nominative and sometimes the accusative, that's the subject and object, that you can tell them apart. Once you get into any other case, genitive, dative and stuff, then they are the same as each other, identical in form. So you can't tell except from context. And you can't always tell from context which it is. So, Val, finish off that paragraph.
So in verses like this one, and in the Lord's Prayer, deliver us from evil, the phrase...
Yes.
Ectu poenum.
Very good. Ectu poneru.
Could refer to an abstract entity from evil, or to something, someone more personal from the evil one. What difference do you think this makes?
Yes. And there is no right answer. It's no good saying, which is it? Did Jesus say or mean from evil or from the evil one? Because he said, in Greek, ectu poneru. So he said both. And it's no good saying, which is it? That's a question you only ask in a different language, really, because you have to translate it somehow. He sort of meant both, or didn't distinguish, or something. So my question, Rich, I would like to talk about a bit, is how helpful is it to personify abstracts like evil? And to ask a more pointed question, in 1980, they took the devil out of the baptism service in the Church of England, and we used to renounce evil. And in 2000, they put him back in, if it is a him. I think the devil's probably female. It's only on the balance of probabilities, you understand, and personal experience. And so we now resist the devil. All right, sorry. We now resist the devil.
Uh-huh.
Or renounce the devil. We renounced evil in 1980, and we renounced the devil since 2000. Being a sort of liberal Christian, I have not gone back to the devil. I use the 2000 service for baptism, the 1980 service for baptisms. But Did you know this thing? Did you know about the evil and evil one? And what?
Yes, because you told us about it several months ago.
Right. I looked up in my notes on my Yeah, I looked up in my notes to see if I'd actually written it down. I hadn't. So it must have been a side comment. I thought this sounds familiar to me, but it's nowhere in print yet. We probably had this conversation before, therefore.
Why make an educated guess as to why most translators and paraphrases have opted for evil one?
I think probably because there's an article in front of it, the evil. And although they do often have an article before an abstract noun, there's something about the flavour that suggests personification, I think. And because Jesus quite often talked about the evil one, definitely personified, it's Hoponeros who snatches away the seed in the parable of the sower, or snatches the word out of the hearer's ears. It's Hoponeros. So he obviously did use Hoponeros to mean the evil one. I'm not really educated enough to have much of an idea of whether it's because of the Aramaic that probably lies behind this, except to say that the same thing happens in Aramaic. They do use abstract nouns as they use participles to be abstract nouns. Kohen, the Jewish surname Kohen, means a sacrificing person. It means a priest, therefore. And so that's the sort of way they do things. They use participles, and the same would go on for the devil. He's described by participle. He's the tempting thing or person.
Because traditionally the church has referred to this fallen angel who is mentioned. Is it in Isaiah? And associated that reference to Satan, Beelzebub, whatever title you wish to.
Milton refers to fallen angel.
Milton.
The Bible doesn't very much. The Book of Job gives the clearest indication. Well, there's various places. The Book of Job is the most obvious one to me. Is that what we now think of as being Satan is in some ways an angel, but a rather dodgy one. Mm. And you need to understand that in Islam, for example, Satan does not mean the devil. So when Iran calls America the great Satan, they are not saying what Americans hear them to say. And if we get a nuclear war between them because of semantics, it just proves how important language is.
So what do they mean?
In Islamic thought, Satan is a redeemable part of God's creation. A redeemable part of God's creation. In Christian thought, Satan is not a redeemable part of God's creation. And that makes a big difference. They see Satan as, like the fallen angel thing, having wandered from the true path, but with the potential, and in much Islamic thought, the likelihood of being brought back to it. So it does have a very different emotive colouring.
And we definitely do not think it's...
I don't know who we are. In the Book of Revelation, the destiny of, is the fairy of the fiery pit sort of stuff. All the sort of typology of the Bible is almost to make the devil, or whatever phrase one's using at this point, into like a bad god, a sort of nexus of evil that is stands for everything that opposes God, and in the end loses, is destroyed. Whereas Islam has kept that sense of a less powerful Satan, who is a sort of gone wrong angel with much more sense of being ultimately under the control and possibly the merciful purposes of God. So, the great Satan does ring differently in Muslim ears. Language is so dangerous, isn't it?
Is he a force of evil in Islam?
Oh, you do need to ask somebody better than me about this. The more I talk, the more wrong I'll be. It's kept its force of accusing. Satanos is an accuser. Mm. I know that, and of tempting, and of leading astray. Mm. But I'm afraid I shall only try and tell you more than I really know if I get much further.
But the accuser is also used in the Bible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of the way evil comes to us, when it's personified.
Yes. It'd be quite interesting sometime to sort of list the ways in which what we think of as the devil is described. There isn't really no word for devil in Greek. Diabolos is the nearest you get, and that that isn't the devil.
Yeah.
That is a devil. Yeah. Mary Magdalene, or probably wasn't her, but somebody had seven diaboloi. So that doesn't mean the devil. It's another way of talking about demons, perhaps. So you could look at them. You've got Beelzebub, haven't you? You've got the accuser with a capital A. You've got Satanas, Satan. You've got Hoponeros, the evil one.
You've got that town where they burned things on the edge of...
Yes, that's more for hell. That's more for hell, Gehenna. Yes, if that's what you're thinking.
So the trouble about Satan, the devil, is you're in danger of running into a dualism of the good God and the bad God.
Very much so.
So that's... While if you say evil, if it's a sort of force that does nasty things.
Yes, I guess we will vary on this.
That's the reason. Oh, well, one of the reasons.
Yes, I guess for this room we probably vary on this. As you can tell, my taste is not to talk much to the devil, but to talk about evil. Because that works better in my head, and more importantly, I think it works better in people's ears. When you're dealing with semi-church people who bring children for christening, I don't want to go back into echo medieval mythology. I want to try and help them into modern people to understand the issues that we're talking about.
Who's Lucifer?
Oh, thank you, Lucifer, yes. Lucifer is the morning star who appears to be inappropriately rivaling the sun and who loses every morning.
But wasn't he a fallen angel as
yes.
well? Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes. We're really into Milton now. Yeah, but the imagery there is the morning star, that's the last bastion of night that is vanquished by the rising sun.
Jesus calls Peter Satan.
Yes, he does.
He tries to say, no.
Yes, yeah. He does. So if you're a keen Bible student, you get out the right sort of commentary and just look up all these different phrases and see what word is used where. And you're quite right, it's Satanos is used there. The accusing one, leading astray, diverting him from his true calling. Not the nexus of all evil.
Do the Islamists, the Muslim faith, regard us all as Satan then, because we're not following their path, or just America, or perhaps
it's just become a phrase they use about America, isn't it?
So are we somewhere between America and
it depends on how fundamentalist a Muslim is. It's like talking to a Southern Baptist Christian or a sophisticated
they believe that we haven't
London liberal
will only be improved by joining them.
Well, we believe they'll only improve by joining us. I mean that's right.
I know, but they think we must be fallen, like they think America.
Yeah.
Have a specific name for everybody else other than America.
Yes, the infidels.
It might be somewhere between America and...
Yes, you're quite right. It's sort of non-Trumpian unbelievers. Muslims are like Christians. That they vary from those who are quite sure everyone disagrees with them is destined for hell, which is the noisy section that's in the ascendant at the moment. And those who have got a much more understanding of Allah, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Who really have a sense that we'll meet our friends of different religions in heaven, sort of thing. It's very parallel to Christianity in its breadth, from fundamentalism, exclusivity at one end, and liberal inclusiveness at the other. But the fundamentalists are making all the noise at the moment, partly because they threaten to kill those who say otherwise.
In answer to your specific question, I guess over about the last 20 years or so, I've become less concerned about issues surrounding a personal devil and more concerned about the insidious influence of evil and all its manifestations in the world.
And ultimately, whether in our heads we imagine some personal agency behind it or don't is ultimately relevant if we're talking about, I think it is, about what our calling is to combat evil in the world. So we really shouldn't fall out about it, because Christians do disagree. Mm-hmm. Any last comments on this particular thing? Liz, your thoughts on modern Christian, for example?
Well, I would I think I would echo what Mike said. Certainly when I was a child, I think it was taught in very clear black and white terms, but how much that was because I only understood it in a naive way, and how much that was actually the teaching of the church, it is a little bit hard to disentangle. If you were trying to resist evil, it can be helpful to personify it, I think. It kind of seems more tangible.
Like Jesus in the wilderness.
But then on the other hand, if you also are aware that, I think Mike is saying, the structures of the world and the trading patterns that we have are set up in such a way that they disadvantage poorer people. Well, we might say that that is the structural evil, that it's actually a lot more complicated than, you know, the sort of Sunday school idea, isn't it, really? And it's not about the naughty but nice being tempted to eat a second cream bun. I mean, that's neither here nor there, really.
I remember that. I'll remind you of that.
In terms of what Jesus' priorities are.
In some ways, I hope nobody's going to misunderstand what I'm saying here. In some ways, a personal devil can be a cop-out. Oh, the devil made me do it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what Eve said, wasn't it? Yeah. It was all the snake's fault.
Yeah.
When we were in Woking, there was that vicar in Knapp Hill who refused to resign. He had an affair with a parishioner and refused to resign because he had a demon made him do it.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we could all say that, couldn't we? It was extremely hard to pry out of his post because he wouldn't go quietly. Thank you. Okay, shall we move on to the Lord's Prayer? Is there anything else in chapter 17 you're aware of you want to ask about?
Yes, I'm very interested if you gave us a short discourse on your understanding of the word glory.
Yes. It's also in the Lord's Prayer, of course. But it isn't. Hallowed. It isn't, actually. No, Doc Sadson said, glorify yourself or glorify me. I'm itching to do what I can't in my head, which is to go back into the Hebrew, because I'm convinced it's got those roots, because the glory of God is such a huge thing there. The glory of your name is such a Hebrew old-fashioned Old Testament phrase, and that's all in John 17.
Name, I understand.
Yes.
The character.
Yes. What they stand for. Glory. Well, I'll do what I can in Greek, which is that doxa, which means the usual word for glory.
Yes.
It comes originally from dokio, which is to seem, or to do with appearance, or to have an opinion of. So in one direction it's to seem like something, in the other direction it's to have an opinion about something. It's to do with how something is related to or observed, dokio. It can also mean, it seemed good to me to eat a second cream bun, as Liz was saying. If it wasn't temptation, it was my opinion. That would be the dokio word. So it's to do with the measure we give things. And doxa, which is to do with glory, is to do with that. It's to do with giving God God's due, or giving Jesus Jesus' due. That's the semantic root of it, in Greek terms. But I think probably the Hebrew background is more important, which I confess I am vaguer about. I can't say much more about it. Well, I can talk for ages about these things, but not with great confidence. I can't. Sorry. You hit a relatively shallow bit of my knowledge there, I think.
Just one thing I wanted to say before we move on, which, just looking at this again this afternoon, I find it both very moving and very encouraging, the way that Jesus prayed this great prayer, praying for the disciples and the church to come.
And the church to come, yes.
This is God himself personified in Jesus praying such a passionate prayer for us.
Yeah. And the great thrust of the prayer is that we should embody in our corporate life the relationship that there is within God, between the Father and the Son. That's the big one. Specifically, that's talked about as our unity, if that's the right word for it. Interestingly, John never uses the word unity, henotes. Paul uses it a lot. But he does use the word one a lot, hen. Which is, I think, his way of saying unity, to do with unity. So above all, in our unity, that we should reflect the nature of God, which we've been very bad at doing. It is very moving, yes, well worth saying. It seems quite repetitive, in fact it is repetitive at times, the prayer, but there is a progression which, if you compare it to the Lord's Prayer, you'll see some of the same progression in that chapter, and I think John's done that on purpose. John doesn't have a Last Supper, he has the I am the Bread of Life chapter. He doesn't have a Lord's Prayer, he has John 17. So he's sort of, I think John is assuming a knowledge of the other Gospels on the part of his readers. And so he's actually taking them further. Okay, I may have to run and fetch a Greek New Testament in a minute, because I should...
Is that one under
there? Oh, is the one, that's Hebrew.
What's that little one there, to the left of it?
Yes, it's Greek, thank you. Thank you. So, shall we whiz through? I'll just touch on things, and you can get me to say more if you want, or you can say more yourself, of course, to share how it strikes us. If we follow in, if you've got a Bible and want to follow, well, you can just follow my sheet, can't you? It's all there. But Matthew's got the longer version. the idea is that Matthew has probably Jewished up the version in Luke. Also, of course, Jesus would have used this prayer many, many times in many places, and probably not in one set form. It got sort of codified when the church used it. But probably Jesus used something pretty similar, but not identical, throughout his ministry. And so it's no good asking which is the correct version. Matthew gives the more Jewish version. Our Father is Pater in Greek, as it would be in Latin, by the way. But we know from elsewhere in the Gospels that lying behind that Pater in Greek is what Jesus would actually have said, which is Abba, which is Dad or Daddy. And very few Christians dare to say Dad in their prayers. But Jesus sort of taught us to. But even by the time it was written in Greek, Pater, they could have used a more childish version, Papa or something, but they didn't. So already you see people shrinking from that intimacy with God that Jesus taught. Matthew can't even cope with Father. He Jewishes it and adds in heaven, because it feels too intimate, too informal just to say Father to Matthew or his, perhaps his hearers, his readers. I'll sort of go slowly and chip in and ask if you want. Hallowed be your name. I'm just checking. I imagine that's Hagiadzo, not Doxadzo, which would be the glory that Jane mentioned. Matthew 6, 9. Yes, Hagios Theto. So that's Hagios, which is holy. And in Greek, Hagios largely means morally holy. In Hebrew, the word usually for holy isn't such a moral word. It is a moral word, but it's more a cultic word of being set apart. And in primitive religion, they were more interested in cult than in morality. That an adulterer could worship God in the temple, but a menstruating woman couldn't, for example. Because actually the cultic, the ritual cleanliness, which is often linked to things like bodily fluids, not just female ones, the ritual purity in primitive religion is got more weight than morality. And in a sense, throughout the Old Testament, you see that balance shifting. And if anything, the great gift that the Jews gave humanity was to teach that God is not interested in cult so much as in morals. The prophets doing this, you know, I despise your burnt offerings, treat the poor properly. there's a great thing going on across centuries in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. The primitive bits of Leviticus are very cultic, very ritualistic. The later parts of the Old Testament are very moral. And Jesus, so in a sense, continues that trend and accelerates that trend. So the word holy in Hebrew has got a lot of... The word means separate. Means separate. The word holy in Greek means good. When it means hallowed be your name, well, it's a bit like the glory thing. I mean, how deep do we go what that means? It means, well, your name is holy. I suppose it means may we hallow it. You know, put us in the right place. We're not asking God to change. We're aligning ourselves with God in our praying by saying, please put me in that relationship with you as holy. And we touched on name before, I think. Mike had mentioned it. It seems strange in our culture because we don't do it much. But in other cultures, it's still primitive cultures especially. You know, you don't tell somebody your name because that gives them power over you. When Jesus wants to drive out demons, at least one occasion, he asked them what their name was. Mm-hmm. And once he knew the name, he could get rid of them. Even in England, people were quite shy about giving their real name to people until a century or so ago. You wouldn't have your real name used at the office. You'd be known by a nickname or by your initials. And only those you really trusted would be allowed to use your real name.
And even husbands and wives call themselves Mr. and Mrs., didn't they?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
My auntie was always Mrs. Shaw. She was never Doris. Always Mrs. Shaw. Maybe I to a fact paper, but Mrs. Shaw.
And in modern stuff, in internet chat rooms, I almost always use my real name because there's this process of reversing it, that we don't want to give you power over us by admitting who you are. So everyone comes with pseudonyms and says rude things to each other from behind the shelter of it. And I think that there's an openness that we need in relating. So, yes, the name is to do with the nature of the identity.
And as I understood it, it is the character. So it would almost be hallowed be your character rather than yeah. your actual personal
yes name. Yes yes
or office
if
character the office
yes it, does God have
what
character
you are, but not who you are
yes what yes. you are not who you are yes, yes that's rather good thank you mm-hmm. yes because character sounds almost too anthropomorphic for God yes yes very good. May your kingdom come. Again, we get nervous of this now. We need to be very, very alert to modern trends if we're going to be useful Christians. And all domination talk is quite difficult in people's ears. We are a democracy, not a kingdom, for example. And so where does that fit with the language that you use about God? Many Christians now shrink from using the word Lord for God. There's a process which we need to be aware of how things sound in people's ears. And I think with God, we perhaps should use those words. Perhaps only with God should we. But but I mean, again, it's all up for grabs in some ways, I think. Don't forget King and Lord are both male words as well. So don't forget there's a whole stuff going on there which we need to listen to and not just tut about with modern people. But kingdom, sticking with the word because it's the word we have in the Greek, it is not a place geographically. I mean, the closest English word, I think, to kingdom is even more old-fashioned. It's Raj. Yeah. The Raj is not a place. It's the fact of British rule in India. And the kingdom is not a place. It's the fact of God's rule on earth or in eternity. But obviously Raj is not a good example for most people because it then starts having colonial overtones. But I mean, in pure linguistic terms, I think that's the closest we get to it in English. Because kingdom suggests to us a place, if we use the word in its normal way of being used in English. So it's more like, it's as much kingship as kingdom. But kingship is talking about the person. Whereas king...
Your reign.
Yes, thank you, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yes. I think before I go any further, it's probably worth saying that most commentators see the Lord's Prayer as based around May God's new order come into the present world order. You can do it in terms of time. May God's future be seen today. Or you can do it in terms of sort of pseudo-space. May God's environment invade the earth. It's a prayer which is trying to draw the two together. That's the sort of whole thrust of it. It's what in the trade we call eschatological, which is not the same as scatological. In fact, it's almost the opposite. Eschatological. But that's the great thrust of the prayer, which we'll see in a minute with daily bread. But I think that's how we see it all. So where's that kingdom come?
Good old Peterson, who was always quite revolutionary.
Yep.
He said, he starts like this: Our Father in heaven, reveal who you are. Set the world right. Do what's best. As above, so below.
Yeah, that sounds best. That sounds best. Does that sound good? Your will be done. I've not got anything very clever to say about.
But do you think all prayer Sorry. Is eschatological?
Yes, maybe. Prayer for parking spaces.
Well, I'm not so heavily into that.
That's it.
Anyway. we all know somebody who is. That's why I mentioned it. Sorry, yes.
I went on a retreat recently where I was encouraged to think more deeply about prayer. And the guide didn't actually use that word, but the way that we were talking, I was coming to that conclusion that prayer isn't about trying... Sometimes we think prayer is about trying to change one's mind, don't we?
If we're not careful...
If we're not careful, it's like we're trying to check... Yes, we're asking things for ourselves.
We're trying to persuade God.
We're trying to persuade God to see things from our point of view. But actually, it's completely the opposite, I think, that prayer is about us being open and expressing that openness to try and understand things from God's point of view and to invite God's point of view and way of working to be more evident in ourselves and in our communities and all the things that we're concerned about. And that is maybe a more realistic way of... Well, not just
a more Jesus-like.
A more honouring to God way of thinking about it. I mean, Jane is a thoughtful person. I'd be interested to know what you think.
Yes, I always try to think of prayer as transforming us.
Yes.
To me, it's being with God.
Mm.
When we do pray for other people, which seems valid because Jesus did, then it is... I mean, I agree, I think that...
When we pray for other people, it's us getting emotionally involved and compassionate towards people and developing our compassion for those around us and for those that are in trouble.
Yes.
So it's a slightly different way of looking at it. It's
not a and if prayer is praying for other people is a triangle. There's us, there's them, and there's God.
Yes.
We often think of prayer as being us asking God to do something to them.
Yeah.
Whereas it's perhaps that's the one movement at least is. It's the two other movements. It's us trying to get God's understanding and compassion for that person, and it's us trying to. Have God's outlook on that person. I mean, it's the same thing twice, but I mean, it's the other two sides.
But God already has compassion for that person.
Yes. So the one thing it isn't doing is asking God to do something, to do something different.
Yeah.
It isn't that. Lord, you're being mean to this person. Please be nicer to them. Mm. Yes.
God, for some obscure reason, always wants to be told, although he knows it already.
Mm. Yes.
But he likes being told.
Because it makes us
more. Yes, if we try and work out why God likes to be told, it's probably for these reasons, I think. Because it makes us have God's point of view more.
Yes.
Not God have ours.
Isn't that the definition of worship? Telling God things about himself that he knows already.
Well, yes, that's the definition one's heard, that's right. Yes, I know. Well, I mean, that is a slightly cynical way of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
But the reason one does that is not to inform God. It's to
inform us.
Yes,
really.
And to inform our hearts and to change our hearts.
Seal it inside.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I mean, just very quickly on the kingdom, it's one of the things that I guess If I had to sum up where most of my thinking and reading from a Christian perspective has been over the last few years, it would be, what is the kingdom and what are the implications for us now?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's right. Yes. I mean, what's it mean for God to be God on earth and in reality, in our lives and in society? Yes.
Yeah.
I think one of the best things is, I can't remember who said it, but some worthy Bob, he said silence is the language of God.
Mm. Yes. Well, I mean, agreed. I mean, there's a sense in which you can go through all this stuff into a deeper silence. It isn't a shallow silence instead of this stuff.
Yep. It's being with God and in silence.
On earth as it is in heaven.
Yes. Because you said you weren't going to.
I want to be interrupted.
Goya, who wrote the Archbishop's Lent, had an interesting take on this. No comer after done. So your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's not doing things. It's what is done in heaven is done with a righteous, compassionate attitude. It's about attitudes rather than God imposing what he wants done. This is for in the kingdom.
Yes. Now, there is indeed, there's no punctuation in Greek at all in the original copies.
Yeah.
And it's also worth knowing that that phrase is the other way around in the Greek. It isn't on earth as in heaven, it's as in heaven so on earth. Which links it, as you're saying, I think, Jane, all the more closely to the will of God.
Yeah.
As your will is in heaven, let it be on earth.
Yes.
It's more closely linked in the word order in Greek as well. Heaven and earth, just worth being aware of, they use very physical words there. Nowadays, heaven for us has become a spiritual thing in English. That's the last few centuries. Even 300 or 400 years ago, the word heaven meant sky. There was no distinction. In French, the Lord's Prayer in French is Notre Père qui est en ciel, who is in the sky. Uranos in Greek means heaven and sky. There is no separate word for heaven and sky in Greek. There is no separate word for heaven and sky in French. There was no separate word for heaven and sky in English. We've imported the word sky. They didn't use it a few centuries ago. So we have done our usual trick of developing a spiritual language. I think in this case helpfully, actually. But sometimes unhelpfully. We have angels. They don't come in the Bible either. So we invent words, which are spiritual words, to make things religious. We've done that with heaven, which is probably a good thing. And earth is the word geis, which is the word geological, which means soil and rock. So we've got very physical stuff here. Now, I'm just telling you that because it is the case, not because I'm trying to explain anything from it. If anything, as I've hinted already, I think it's good if we soften that, because that is still using a primitive language for God. But you see, when you try and do it more sophisticatedly, people get very alarmed. One of the great problems that Bishop John Robinson had at Honest to God in the early 1960s, and some of you are old enough to remember that, is he was trying to do away with physical and spatial language for God. Following Tillich, he called God the ground of our being. He said things like, there is no heaven. And he was trying very hard to use a different vocabulary, non-spatial, non-physical, to talk about God. And personally, I think that's an excellent thing to do. However, it's worth noticing that in terms of the language used, that Jesus and the Greek New Testament are still using a very primitive way of talking. Daddy in the sky. That's how the prayer starts. Again, I'm not trying to make a point from that, except to say, notice how primitive the language is, and it's probably a good thing to try and do it in a more sophisticated way for unbelievers' ears.
Well, and for our own ears, surely, because we want to have a deep and full understanding.
Yes. So when we use these words, our thoughts are not that simple. I mean, people, non-Christians call us various things. They call us God-botherers and so on. They say that we believe in a sky fairy. You see, they're deliberately using these words to parody, because the words themselves invite parody. And you're quite right. We need to be able to give a sophisticated account I don't mean all to be terribly clever, but we need to be aware of the depth of this and not believe in sky fairies.
Or people in long white nighties sitting on clouds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The cartoonist's god.
Although...
sorry.
Yes?
I was going to say, I was listening to a very interesting programme on Radio 4 the other day about the idea which, according to these... whatever they are, sociologists and religious theorists, not to say Christian, has apparently come to be prevalent in the last 10 years, that when people die, they become angels.
Oh, yes.
And that's quite a common view now.
Yeah,
apparently it started with that woman, Jade Goody, and it's sort of fostered by social media and things, this idea that when people die, they are transformed into these ethereal beings, and it's apparently terribly, terribly common now, particularly amongst younger
people,
and it's the sort of way that they use. I mean, whether they actually believe that or whether it's just how they describe it.
And started with Jade Goody. I'd missed that one. Thank you.
And I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I heard the trailer for the programme, but I didn't actually hear
it. Yeah, and the programme was very interesting. It was giving lots of examples, and it was talking about how the internet had encouraged it. And,
But picking up on the point you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, John, what the New Testament talks about for the Christian is a future physicality.
Mm.
Whereas...
I saw a new heaven and a new earth.
Yeah, we tend to have forgotten about that, and we think our ultimate destination is heaven, but the New Testament doesn't say that.
Well, another session we can discuss to what extent physical language is analogous. What's the resurrection of the body mean? When we now know in atomic terms that our bodies consist of molecules that were in other people's bodies down the ages. There's a bit of Hitler in all of us, literally. That's the way it works at a molecular level. So, yeah, indeed. We share molecules with people who lived before. So, yes, to what extent is physical talk, the new heaven, new earth, an analogy? But I think...
Which all, for me, spins back into what is the kingdom.
For me, it talks about what is a person. Resurrection of the body, for me, means the preservation of the identity, that I'm not a Buddhist, that my ambition is not to be absorbed into the great cosmic one like a raindrop into the ocean. That's the nirvana for a Buddhist. The Christian vision is the almost exact opposite, that we have transformed identities. We come now to the hardest word in the Lord's Prayer, the word daily. Give us this day, well, it's today in the new version, and that's what the Greek means, are something bread. The word only occurs there in the New Testament. It only occurs there in Greek. It is never found anywhere else ever, so nobody knows what it means. It's as simple as that. The word in Greek, in case you're interested, is epiousios. Epi means, it's a prepositional prefix meaning something like to or at. Ousios is the participle from the word to be. It's like the English word essential or essence, which is the Latin version of it. And so, epiousion.
But the French is quite good. It's done in a little
bit. De chaque jour. Well, they've jumped very firmly on epiousios, meaning for every day, for each day. English word daily. That's the usual translation. Yep.
It's interesting. In the New Living Translation, it says, "Give us our food for today."
Yeah.
Asterisk, or yeah. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
There's some thought that the image being used is of manna. You can't keep it overnight; it goes off.
Mm-hmm.
There's some thought that lies behind this thought, that we pray to God as we follow Him through the wilderness of the world, for manna. Enough for today. If you store it and keep it in a box, it gets maggoty. That's what happened to the manna.
Mm-hmm.
And so each day we rely on God for what we need that day. We don't store up
treasures for ourselves on earth.
We'll exactly.
Moth and rust do corrupt.
We hook it up to
the Eucharist.
To the Eucharist, yes.
Yes. That was what Augustine did. He had the most ridiculous translation of it, super substantialis, which means super sub, that's an oxymoron, super means above and sub means below. Stantialis, stant is a bit like essence, it means standing, having existence. So super substantial was his translation of it, which I think, as far as bad translation goes, is probably one of the worst. But I agree with the idea devotionally of linking to the Eucharist. It's an excellent idea.
I think there is a talk out there.
Yes, I think it's an excellent idea devotionally. I think linguistically it's a hopeless translation, that one.
And because I was given a lecture by Abbot Stewart on that very word once. I had the privilege of 20 minutes of his time when he expounded to me the daily.
Yeah. I think your version, which has a footnote, which saying today's bread or tomorrow's, actually gets it in one. Yeah. Scholars are divided whether it means bread for today only, or whether it's what I was saying about God's future coming to the present. Do you remember I gave that, said what's happening in the prayer? Yeah. Is give us tomorrow's bread today. Give us the bread of the kingdom on earth. Whether it's that's the thought.
I would like to think it's continually sustains us.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Tomorrow or today.
Yes.
Continually.
Yeah.
I can't remember Jane because I think you read it when William's disciple book. Mm. He goes into quite detail about this.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's fine. No, not surprised.
About the Lord's
Prayer. Yeah.
And how he perceives it.
You could also argue that epiusios means enough to get by on and no more. Mm-hmm. That it's bread, not cake. You could argue that from the word epiusios, that it's iron rations. It's food for the task. It's not luxury filling up.
And it's got something to do with the basics of life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it has. Epiusios. It's the bread for being.
You mentioned the word essential. That's
essential, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, ousios means essential. That's the Greek for the Latin essens.
As opposed to, I mean, I think the New Living, because that's mine, it says need as opposed to what we want.
Yes, that's exactly right.
We want a lot of things.
Give us the bread, give us the food we need.
Right. Not what we want.
Yes, very good. I'm sure that's getting it too.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's today, not tomorrow. It's not a whole week's worth in one go. Mm. It's luxury. It's fuel for a task. It's not luxury for indulgence. Yeah.
But it's not just talking about physical food, is it? It's yeah. Mental and spiritual and everything.
Yes. Yes. Okay. As I say, I there's no correct answer because you can put into that word epiusios what you want. It's got all those flavours we've had. Now, Matthew then says, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Luke says, forgive us our sins as we forgive everyone who indebted to us. So, the Jewish thinking, they like, they're quite monetary thinking, so it's all about debt. Scottish, of course, they like the Jews, they're fond of money. So, they also, the Lord's Prayer in Scotland is debts, not trespasses. English are more landowners. And the squirearchy run the church, country gentlemen are in charge in our villages, and so we talk about trespassers whom we shoot or catch with man traps. So which word you use in Lord's Prayer depends on your social background.
It's debts in Latin.
Thank you. Is it? Yes.
I always think it ought to be if. We also
forgive
our debtors.
Excellent.
As.
Let's talk about that.
I always think it should be if.
yes, that's very interesting. Okay, let's talk about that. That's more important.
Okay, conditional.
That's more important. Is it conditional?
Mm.
Yes. The Greek word is definitely as. It's hos or ephos, which just means the same. I teach people that it's the same action as forgiving and receiving. That you cannot receive without letting go. That's the image I use. So God doesn't reward us for forgiving people. If we forgive our neighbour, God then rewards us. It's the same process. Does God withhold forgiveness from us because we aren't good enough? Because we're grudge-bearing minge bags? It's the same action helps us receive it. It doesn't cause God to give it. So if is right that we only receive if we let go, if we forgive, but what drives it is not reward for getting our end of it right. What drives it is our potential to receive grace that's there anyway. So that's what as means for me. The same action that receives also lets go. And we cannot receive forgiveness if we're not forgiving. That's how I teach it. But it's not different from what you said at all.
I think on this point, Peterson is quite helpful. Worry, I find him singularly unhelpful on daily bread. But anyway, yep. On this point, he says, if you refuse to do your part, you cut yourself off from God's part.
Yep.
It's not a quid pro quo. It's if you keep yourself tight and
yep.
shut up like that, you're actually depriving yourself of something that God wants to do for you.
And in the parable of the unforgiving servant, which is the closest match in the teaching of Jesus, I think, to this, the king forgave the indebted servant first. And then his unforgiveness of his fellow servant made him unable to benefit from the king's forgiveness. The king was not so impressed by him having forgiven his servant that he agreed to write the debt off. He didn't say, you were really nice there, okay, I'll forgive you your debt. He forgave him his debt anyway, but then the servant rendered himself incapable of receiving that benefit by still clinging on. It's only a parable, it's not an exact match. The king didn't withdraw forgiveness in a sense. The servant disabled himself from receiving forgiveness. Yeah. It's a very powerful image, though.
But sometimes we have difficulty, don't we, in forgiving ourselves. Never mind how God is involved. You know, we give ourselves a hard time, go over and over with things that we think we should have done differently, and beat ourselves up about things, and then we do the same to other people, because we beat them up endlessly about the things that they should have done, perhaps to make us feel better about the things that we haven't done. I mean, it's all quite sort of... I've just been looking after my grandchildren, you can probably tell. You know, there's strong psychological drivers, aren't there?
And for some of us, it's the opposite problem. We give ourselves too easily.
Yes.
So I do dreadful things and don't really care. So, I mean, depending on psychological disposition, one has a different problem with this sort of theology.
Yes. I mean, there are probably fewer psychopaths ones who give themselves a hard time, I think.
They probably are.
Yes. But you have to know your own weaknesses.
Yes.
On that topic, I found the book What's So Amazing About Grace.
Yeah, Philip Yancey.
Yes, very, very powerful.
It is.
Because I read it just after I'd had my breakdown, actually. And it reassured me of the goodness of God towards me.
Yeah.
And if that was true for me, how God wanted that to be reflected from me onto other people.
Yeah, I'd recommend that book to everybody, partly because it's so easy to read. I don't mean that patronisingly, because you actually can just simply read it and benefit and lend it to people. What's So Amazing About Grace? Absolute classic.
It's a bit of filtering is required because it's written into an American context.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still very, very powerful.
Yancey's books, which are brilliantly readable, that they all assume people have been brought up as naive evangelicals like him. But, I mean, once you understand that, then they work well. We must move on. Don't bring us to the time of trial. We've done this before, have we?
Yeah, so.
I can't think where in John's Gospel. Peirasmos, the difference between testing and tempting. Have we done this one?
Yes.
I thought we had. Yes, okay.
Well, I've heard you speak of it, whether it was here or in the sermon, I'm not sure.
Okay. It does not primarily refer to moral temptation, though it can include that. It's more to do with the ordeal of persecution or opposition. Do not bring us to is... oh, golly, we'll talk for ages about this. It appears to imply that God might lead us into temptation if we use the old-fashioned Lord's Prayer. He is not in temptation implies that he might lead us into temptation. Why would God do that? That's wrong on various counts. Because it doesn't mean temptation to begin with. It means trial and testing and so forth.
That's because of that wobbly subjunctive.
Yes, the wobbly subjunctive doesn't help. This does tend to be affected by the Hebrew because Latin's only got two moods, really. Well, if you don't count participles and infinitives and things, it's got indicative and subjunctive, and English has, you know, if I was you, if I were you. If you know grammar, you'll know all this. There are two moods, as we call them, indicative and subjunctive. Greek sort of had three, but then one fell off. That's the optative. Arabic's got nine, Hebrew has five. So they're much more subtle in their nuancing of who is doing what and how they're doing it, to what extent they're doing it, with what degree of intent they're doing it. Now, those things are covered by moods, as we call them in English or in Latin. They're called themes in Hebrew. And it's got much more subtle ones, and this is one of the subtle ones. It's been bunged in the subjunctive in Greek. And so it does not mean that God is likely to do this to us. It's more to do with what God allows to happen. It's one of those moods.
Mm-hmm.
And to lead into temptation or trial probably has more overtones in Greek than it does in English of actually succumbing to temptation. So it's not about experiencing temptation, it's more about being overwhelmed by temptation. That's what the phrase to lead into means more there. And so what it really means is it's getting closer to saying don't cause us to succumb to temptation, and actually because of the way the it's a hifil or a hofal or something in Hebrew, which is the subjunctive in Greek, it's more like not don't allow us to succumb to temptation, but please cause us not to succumb to temptation. So by the time you put it through various filters like that, it's actually starting to make a bit more sense if the phrase means cause us not to succumb to temptation, which I think is an allowable translation of what Jesus is saying.
Mine says keep us from being tested.
The Pope wants to change age. Sorry, about what you're saying, sorry.
Mine says keep us from being tested.
Yes, yes, well, it's got the testing bit. And I think it probably doesn't get the succumbing to testing bit, because I don't think God will keep us from being tested, but he can cause us to not succumb to it. And Peterson's got something even longer phrase. But tell us about the Pope, though.
Yes. Can you remember the phrase that he wanted instead? What I know is...
The Pope is trying to change it.
Yes.
Has it reached Fairford yet? No. Oh, well. No, he hasn't told you. Oh, well. It was in the papers recently, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something to do with what we're talking about here. Though
well,
good.
He feels that God shouldn't be blamed for
yes.
leading you into temptation.
Yes. Exactly. So he's trying to find some other
when
phrase.
Did you say that, then?
About 3 months ago.
Yes.
About 3 months ago, thereabouts.
I'm trying to think. Forget that I've actually heard what you said. Yeah, thank you.
Ask your priest. He should know. He's got a hotline to the Pope, hasn't he? Yep.
Peterson says, keep us safe from ourselves and the devil.
Yeah, he's quite imaginative, isn't he? Yep. And we've done the last one. Rescue us from the evil one, Topineros. Folks, I think we've finished.